Welcome to another episode of Conduct Detrimental. I'm Dan Lust and joined by Dan Wallach. Today, we're going to focus on some NFL issues, and we are blessed with two mega topics. One topic, which we have covered extensively, the St. Louis Rams relocation lawsuit. But another story, maybe equally as big, the John Gruden email leak slash Washington football team saga. And as we'll get into, there might be some nexus between these two stories. So we have a very special guest today who coincidentally has been covering both of these. Charles Robinson, NFL senior writer for Yahoo Sports. We spoke to him offline. He's been following our coverage, as of basically the whole country, Dan, on the St. Louis Rams relocation stuff. And then Charles wrote a really interesting article. He had the scoop that John Gruden might be exploring some litigation against the Raiders and maybe the NFL. So, Dan, before we get to Charles, what do you think? I mean, we've been blessed with some pretty good topics recently.
Yeah, well, I mean, the cavalry is showing up in St. Louis. I remember Mike Florio from Pro Football Talk was decrying the lack of media coverage or national media coverage around this lawsuit. Charles has put his imprimatur on this case with this really terrific analysis of how our two topics today intersect with one another. And we're going to talk about that at a little bit greater length, but this is an amazing time in which to be covering the legal side of the NFL. I don't think since Deflategate or the lockout back in 2011 has there been this confluence of major legal stories intersecting all at once. And I think possibility of the Gruden litigation or just the story around the Washington football team and the NFL going before a St. Louis jury. For the first time, the relocation guidelines have ever been at issue before a jury. This is an amazing time in the history of covering the National Football League, whether it's legal or non-legal, it's as good as it gets for us.
So let us take this time to remind the audience our podcast is sponsored by Themis Bar Review. Dan, let's just say Themis is very happy with our new audience that's been coming to the podcast. You know, Dan, I know you and I spoke about the numbers offline. We had our best month ever in June, and then we had our best month ever in July, and then August, and then September, and now October. So we're rewriting records over and over, and Themis Bar Review is our first sponsor on the podcast. So we feel very close to those guys. And, you know, I'll just say if you are a law student that's coming anew, or all of a sudden if you're a St. Louis fan that has some thoughts of going to maybe the great Missouri law school or any law school based in St. Louis or Missouri, or just a fan of what we do, obviously keep in mind Themis Bar Review, the top bar prep company in the entire country. Now, Dan, before we get to Charles, which I don't want to bury the lead, we're going to get to Charles very quickly. What are your just initial thoughts on how the Gruden story intersects with the Rams story?
I'm interested in hearing about that from Charles, actually. I think they're two discrete issues, but they're certainly landing like a ton of bricks on the NFL's lap. Because right now, if you look at how the league is doing commercially with their TV ratings, franchise values are going up, you know, revenues are higher, yet the NFL is constantly operating under this giant legal cloud. And no matter how good times are for purposes of, you know, their profits and just how much money the league is raking in, they can't seem to get out of their own way. I don't see that these suits or these two different issues intersect, although it is placing the league under the highest level of scrutiny that it has probably been under since. And I wouldn't even compare this to Deflategate. Deflategate was a minor issue compared to the sort of the system-wide issues that affect how the league conducts its business and, you know, both in the boardroom and with respect to its relocation policy. This is gigantic, and probably not since the USFL trial in those cases and the Raiders lawsuits in the early 1980s is the league's method of doing business being put under the microscope like it is now.
I'll wade into the waters a little. I think to your point, there are all these conspiracy theorists that are putting their hat on and saying, who leaked the emails and why did they do it? And, you know, I'm sure you've seen the same comments I've seen on social media. If this was the NFL that leaked the emails, what motivation would they have? And I've seen, you know, a not insignificant number of people say, hey, they needed something to distract from this mega lawsuit, the St. Louis Rams case, which, Dan, maybe we'll take the hockey assist for that. Maybe that's us that put on the radar. Not that I necessarily believe that conspiracy theory, but I think there is all of a sudden a lot of attention being paid to this case. So is that a viable theory? I don't mind it. I don't mind it at all.
Well, I think we've had a lot to do with it. I mean, look at cause and effect. Before we got involved, nobody was talking about an expansion franchise or how significant the damages award could be or how, you know, viable this notion of the relocation policy being a contract and granting third-party beneficiary rights to the city of St. Louis. I think some commentators are touching upon that very superficially, but within weeks of our coverage of this case, basically gavel to gavel, these theories have picked up a lot of steam because of the legwork that we've put into it, the real digging and legal research that true, you know, practicing lawyers and litigators bring to a case. I'm not saying that journalists can't, but we have tools at our disposal and ways of looking at things through legal analysis and legal research and our history of understanding some of these legal principles that I think have crystallized the issues in the St. Louis relocation lawsuit, where it's not a lottery ticket right now. It's almost a guarantee for the city of St. Louis to be successful in this trial. The question is, to what extent, and will it hold up on appeal?
Dan, it's kind of the utmost compliment to the coverage of this case that people are even conceiving, hey, there's all this new attention on the Rams lawsuit. Maybe that's why the NFL did. So certainly a compliment to us, which I'm happy to take, and all the listeners that have tuned in and made this issue as big as it's been for the last week or two.
I mean, I think we should get a sports bar named after us at the new, you know, St. Louis Pro Football Stadium, if there ever is one. I don't mean to sort of pat ourselves on our back, but we do deserve a lot of credit here because people are talking about this lawsuit. But ultimately, I think Mike Florio is probably gets the giant assist on at least making me pay attention to this lawsuit, because it wasn't until his story in Pro Football Talk on September 14th, 2021, only a month ago, that I even began thinking about this case. And now, not only are we thinking about it, but people of the caliber and with the national audience that someone like Charles Robinson has. And of course, as this gets closer to trial, I mean, the news trucks are going to be pulling up to the St. Louis courthouse if and when this goes to trial, it's going to be on everybody's radar. People like Adam Schefter and Peter King are going to be forced to cover it. Not that they're dodging it, but it will be unavoidable. It will be on every national and local football writer's radar if it isn't already.
And without further ado, again, we have Charles Robinson on the podcast, senior NFL writer at Yahoo Sports. His last two articles that I think picked up a ton of traction, coincidentally, on both of our favorite topics, St. Louis Rams, which we are continuing to stay vigilant on, continuing to report on that. But the Gruden story, which has some shades of Deflategate, and in NFL circles, I think it's something that is very worrisome to NFL HQ and, you know, a number of people, but we'll get into that. So let us kick it over to Charles Robinson of Yahoo Sports.
Joining us on Conduct Detrimental, after a succession of local St. Louis media figures, we have our first national football writer joining us in Conduct Detrimental. He is Yahoo's senior NFL reporter. Recently, he's more like Yahoo's senior NFL legal correspondent, Charles Robinson. Charles, welcome to Conduct Detrimental. It's great to finally, you know, meet you and have you on our podcast.
Yeah, I appreciate it. It's a quiet time in the league legally, right? Nothing going on. Everything's going on. It's all coming together at once. This is great.
Well, how long have you been covering the league? I mean, for me, it's been the last 5-6 years. It just seems as if no matter how well the NFL is doing in the sort of the P&L aspect of the business, there's always this legal cloud surrounding or facing the league from one thing to the next, whether it's lockout, Deflategate, Ezekiel Elliott, the Colin Kaepernick, you know, anthem issue, to, you know, the WFT scandal, Gruden, the St. Louis lawsuit. As in your career, has there ever been anything quite as concentrated and congested as this whirlwind of legal activity?
No, the last 5 years have really been, I mean, I'm old enough that, so I started covering, I graduated from Michigan State in 2000, and my first job in the NFL, I covered the Lions my first 2 years out. And so I'm old enough to remember when it was all the Sherman Antitrust Act, it was always all about, everything was about antitrust and collective bargaining. We've gotten a little further than that now. Now we really are getting into the weeds legally with the NFL. And yeah, I've been, I took a brief, about a 5-year break to do investigative stuff, still kind of kept my hand in the NFL. But I, when I came back out of that, it was right into, like, within 2 years, it was Zeke. And then, the Colin Kaepernick, everything that happened with Colin Kaepernick and that grievance. And as you said, just this litany of nonstop events. Actually, I think when I came out of it, it was Ray Rice, you know, so it was a lot of what was going on from the domestic violence standpoint and a shaping of the personal conduct policy as it pertained to the legal process, much to the dismay of owners. I think there are a lot of owners who feel like the league shouldn't, they should just say, you know what, let the legal process do its own thing and don't make it part of our world. But Lisa Friel is always going to exist there. And so it will always be a big part of the league.
Why do you think the league has so much difficulty with its relationships with players, with transparency? Why do these issues seemingly always follow the NFL when you don't have nearly, you have nothing, you know, in the NBA that's
right.
You know, quite at that level, NHL, even baseball, for all the acrimony between the players' union and the office of the commissioner. It's like, you know, child's play compared to the level of distrust and acrimony between the players in management in the NFL, although many people refer to DeMaurice Smith as a 33rd owner. But still, there's a level of heat here and just transparency issues that seemingly are stick to the NFL like an adhesive.
Well, there's no shortage of players. I mean, first off, just from the, when you think of the sheer number of, we're talking about thousands, you know, 53-man roster times, you know, 32 teams provides ample opportunity for legal entanglements when you talk about players off the field. From the collective bargaining standpoint, I think it's just this league that the animus has continued to exist largely because of the hammerlock the owners have on control over their players where it concerns the contracts, collective bargaining. They always win. They'll always win because they have the wealth and resources to hold the line as long as they need to and break the union. But I also think a big part of this is we spend a lot of time focusing on the NFL and legal aspects because the NFL is so obsessed with controlling its own narrative. It's so obsessed with protecting the image of the Shield. And so it's constantly reaching to either keep something quiet or try to remedy it as quickly as possible and just get to Sunday. Let's get to Sunday. Let's remedy this so we can get to the games, because we know if we can get to the games, our fan base tends to start to focus on the product more than the side issues with the product. So, but I truly think the turning point for the NFL, and maybe in the wrong direction as far as what it wanted, it was really Ray Rice. It was that tape. Once that came out, the NFL got into the deeply into the management business when it came to how they will interact with legal cases, how that will, I guess, for lack of a better word, weave into their own personal conduct policy. The hiring of Lisa Friel, again, I think is still unpopular with some owners who think we don't need to be involved in this. You just let the legal process happen in the courtroom. It shouldn't be happening, you know, in our own executive branch. All of that, the NFL's kind of walked itself into it, right? Let's be real here. That's really what's happened here. And the explosion of social media and just media in general, it's not just the networks. It's not just the newspapers. It's not just some internet sites. It's everybody now. Everybody covers the NFL. You guys cover the NFL. I follow you guys, you know, because the number of legal documents that get brought to the table this morning, I'm like, okay, let's see what the NFL is still trying to get this moved out of St. Louis. Let me read through the, you know, it's literally anybody now can get involved in that process. And I think that's part of what the NFL has had to deal with.
Why a lot of our listeners asked us to bring you on, and not to mention maybe a significant percentage of those are based in St. Louis. We didn't realize necessarily what we stumbled onto, but, you know, there was a real lack of media coverage of the St. Louis Rams case. So you could say, you could be your tinfoil hat guy and say, well, no one was covering it because no one wanted to bite the hand that was feeding them, right? These particular, you know, be it ESPN or Fox Sports, or maybe those guys didn't want to cover this, or obviously the NFL Network doesn't want to cover it because, you know, all these NFL owners are named personally in the lawsuit. I think some of those same narratives are found in this Washington email leak John Gruden saga, right? Because who's in these emails, right? We have no concept. Right? Who could be emailing Bruce Allen? You'd imagine, right? General manager of the Washington, formerly Redskins, now Washington football team, is having email conversations with general managers of other teams, of presidents of other teams. So this really could extend a lot further than we think, right? A guy like Adam Schefter is brought into this, who has connections to, I'm sure, a number of teams, right? A number of different high league sources. So, you know, we wanted to have you on. We've been covering the Rams stuff very closely. Certainly, you know, obviously the Gruden saga, I think, has the potential to be one of these biggest black eyes on the NFL, depending on how they want to handle it. So, you know, you had a story, Charles, that we were covering very closely. I think you were the only one that was on this, at least as far as we're concerned. You know, we thought about it. I'll just, at least from our perspective, John Gruden, at least the narrative that's being told to us, Mark Davis walked into, you know, Raiders HQ that Monday, faithful Monday, had a conversation with John Gruden, then he left. So from our standpoint, you know, we don't exactly know what happened, but I said it makes a lot of sense that a walkaway agreement was reached, that maybe dual non-disparagement agreements to reach confidentiality. That's why Mark Davis hasn't given a statement to the media. That's why Roger Goodell has not given a statement. And that's why John Gruden. It makes a lot of sense to me that that was why everything was buttoned up so quickly. There was maybe an offer that was made to Gruden. He accepted it. And they said, you know what? Let's go our separate ways. We don't have to challenge this in court. You know, I'm happy to admit when I get it right, when I get it wrong. You reported this, that there doesn't appear to be any type of settlement agreement that was reached on that Monday. And I think your reporting is valid. That opens up the door to a potential lawsuit by John Gruden against the NFL and against the Raiders. So I guess I'll give the floor to you. What are you hearing on that end?
Yeah, that's the weird part of this, is that you would have thought that would have been buttoned up before you move forward, right? We wouldn't be talking now about, well, geez, he's still owed this, and now they're going to essentially hammer out what the golden parachute will ultimately be from the guaranteed money that John is still owed. So it's a little bit murky about what Gruden was told, you know, in that meeting. I don't think there's any question that John knew, was made aware. It's an either or here. Either you're going to be fired or you're going to resign. And on the backside of that, we're going to work out what you're going to walk away with in terms of the guaranteed money that's still on your contract. And I can tell you, there's certainly people close to Gruden who feel like he got a raw deal here in terms of the onus being completely put on him. They're not sitting there forgiving what he said in the emails or the content that came out. They're just saying this all fell on John, and it cost John the rest of his career in terms of football. He can no longer, the vantage point they're looking at this is he's done. He's burned for good. And so they're saying there is damage that's been done to him, because why was his identity learned? Where did that come from? Someone clearly in the process. And now I know that some of these emails came up in obviously Dan Snyder's litigation that Bruce Allen was drawn into, but his identity was not revealed in that. It was, ESPN talent or whatever, ESPN personality, whatever it was. And the flip side of that is at some point, someone knew this is John, and someone not only made reporters aware that this was John, but they showed physical emails proving that this was John Gruden in the process. Well, only a limited number of people could have had their hands on that. And I think, though, it comes down to what can John really prove? What could John's, say if John were if he retains legal counsel, it becomes, who did it? Can we prove it? What damages now can we essentially say were incurred because of John's identity being revealed? And you guys would know that better than I would. Like, I'm not a lawyer. I mean,
One more follow, then I'll get back to Dan. This is where I find the most interesting part about your kind of analysis yesterday. For a period of time, I said this was a moot point. You know, people would ask me, could Gruden sue the Raiders? And I go, well, probably signed a walkaway agreement. It's probably a moot point. It's probably signed.
Right.
I guess
right.
That window was still open. The question is, why did Gruden feel the need to resign? This is why I loved your analysis here. You know, it makes a lot of sense. Why would Gruden resign? If Gruden called me and I was his lawyer on that particular day, I'd say, don't sign anything. You have the leverage here. You can make their life really difficult, and you can make this divorce an issue, right?
Right.
Gruden resigned. So I know there was reports, not your report, but Mike Florio over at Pro Football Talk said that at least in his reporting or his sense of it, that leaks would have continued until Gruden was out the door. So here's how I explain. I teach a class at New York Law School. I was teaching them this last night. If someone puts a gun to my head and they say, Dan, you're going to quit your job right now. They put a gun to my head. Right. That's a form of duress. You could say I quit, but it was, as you noted in your article, a form of constructive discharge. You guys forced me to do that.
Yep.
Now, the question is, who forced Gruden to resign? If the NFL is the one behind the leaks, they're the ones that are holding the gun in that sense. But here's this narrative that I'm seeing pick up steam on social media. If this is a random third party, right, maybe a disgruntled paralegal from the law firm, right, or disgruntled, maybe just a random hacker, and they're the ones behind this leaks and it's not the NFL, it's a little bit of a different narrative, because then in that sense, the NFL is just responding to an outside entity. But if the NFL is the one behind the leak, that's certainly going to be a lot different on this kind of duress charge. And now that's where I think the case gets interesting. If John Gruden thinks he has a good faith basis to start this lawsuit, the question that would be sought in discovery, which we're having a lot of fun with on social media, is who was behind the leak? And that's what he kind of indirectly answered from that particular lawsuit, if Gruden does file suit.
Right. And there's another element here too that you could probably answer this question for me. I think a direct path in terms of John Gruden going after the NFL is if Mark Davis were to look at John and say, you know what, all that money that you're owed, you're not getting any of it. I'm going to look at this and I'm not going to pay you anything of this $40 million that still should be guaranteed on your contract because you resigned. I'm not going to pay you any of that. Can John then turn around and say, well, okay, since he's not that, this is now that's actual damages. I'm going to consider that. I have a figure right now, $40 million I should have in my pocket that now I don't have because Mark Davis had this meeting with me and told me you're either fired or you resign. And that was an action that was coming, at least as far as Mark Davis was concerned, the league is looking at him saying, take care of this. We're not going to set that precedent where we're going to step in and, you know, make some kind of unilateral decision here that affects John's future, but you need to do this. Mark did that under what Mark would consider duress, but then tells John, like, I wonder if, is that then a path for John to potentially, if he wanted to, go after the NFL? Because he says, look, there's constructive discharge and now I'm not getting anything on the other side of it. Now they're taking away my $40 million. The NFL now has damaged me directly.
Charles, I think the 40 is a separate issue. Mark Davis and John Gruden can settle their issues and reach an accord on the monies contractually due to John Gruden under the contract. But what the NFL did is a completely separate violation, a different tort. It's, as you mentioned earlier, John Gruden is toast. He's not going to work again in coaching. He's not going to be a TV analyst. His career associated with football is done, and that was visited to him by, you know, presumably somebody with some link right to the National Football League. So even if he has a settlement with Mark Davis, he has, what incentive does he have not to sue the National Football League?
Right.
He's got no fear at all. And I think the interesting angle here is that, you know, Al Davis has a history of suing the National Football League. Wouldn't it be interesting if Mark Davis and Gruden made some kind of a settlement and Gruden gave the Raiders and Dave and Mark Davis a full release, but not the National Football League?
Right.
I would expect him to go after the National Football League. So what are you hearing and what reasons would he have to be disincentivized not to sue the NFL? Because he's got a potentially strong claim here.
Well, because we don't know what else is out there. We have no idea what else could come up. So let's say he in terms of being disincentivized, let's say he feels incentivized, he moves forward with it, and then you have to go through a discovery process. Now you have the league who says, okay, well, now we have to defend ourselves. And I don't know what else John did or said or might, you know, what else might be in electronic communications, might be in text messages, emails. So I don't know that there's not information that people surrounding John are saying, well, what else is out there to come out if you go through this process?
Wait, but he's already been labeled through emails a homophobe, yeah, a racist, and a misogynist. What else could he have been accused of? Did he murder somebody? I mean, this is really, you know, this is like the seventh circle of hell. It can't get much worse for him.
I wouldn't think it can't, but Urban Meyer also probably thought he wasn't going to be taped, you know, with his hands in places that they shouldn't have been taped, which created a whole different type of fallout that had nothing to do with his job.
I think Gruden would trade the two situations and would take Urban Meyer's deal and let Urban Meyer right have his deal. That would be a fair trade-off for Gruden.
But what I'm saying is we don't know, like, what, you know, who knows? I mean, there could be life things in there, okay? There could be things that have absolutely nothing to do with the words that he speaks about players or the league or the commissioner. There could be personal details about John's life, his family. And I'm not suggesting anything here, but I mean, his lifestyle, who knows? I mean, we didn't know anything about Deshaun Watson that we now know prior to March, or at least that has been alleged about Deshaun Watson in a slew of, and I'm not talking about football, I'm talking about personal things about Deshaun Watson that then have become conversations about his personal conduct, his quote unquote lifestyle. You know, I don't know that there aren't elements of that John Gruden would have to consider. You're right. He's burnt, as far as football is concerned, and as far as what he's been labeled, the damage, I don't know how much worse the damage can get, but we don't know what we don't know.
Let's work backwards for a second, because this is where I find this to be so interesting. I'm going to give you a hypothetical, right? They say it during depositions, not to answer any hypotheticals, but it's a podcast. We're not under the
rules. Right.
You know, there had to be, when we talk about contract law, there has to be some type of bargain for exchange. There has to be a meeting of the minds, right? And you kind of laid it out, right? if Gruden is going to resign on the spot, that was the story. It wasn't that he was fired. Certainly there's an argument that he could have been fired for cause. And as you laid out in your article, you know, his attorney's response would be, listen, these emails predated my employment with you guys, so right. I didn't do anything wrong on the job. There's an interesting for cause argument there. But Gruden, for whatever reason, right, and I think this is very important here, basically said, you know what? I don't need to fight that fight. I resign. Now, the question is, what was said to him in order to get him to resign, right? This is why I think there is maybe some teeth to, you know, this duress argument. I don't know why else he would resign, right? And this is the argument that people, and I see the wisdom in this, the NFL was behind the leaks, because you can imagine a hypothetical scenario where Davis goes, hey, we've become aware of these leaked emails. Everyone sees them now. And our understanding, our intel is that more will be leaked until you step down. We'll worry about the rest later, but we need to. There's a Monday Night Football game going on right now. We need to send a message. You need to resign right now or else, John, I can't protect you. I don't know what else is coming beyond that. So, you know, that I think, and I put a poll up on Twitter, just I wanted to see people's responses. You know, 70% of the poll, you know, and we had about 1,000 votes, said that they think that NFL and Goodell were behind the leaks. You know, we can question whether or not that makes sense, why the NFL would want to throw one of its own under the bus and open up the skeletons. But I think that begs the question, what was John told in order to make him resign on the spot? Because he lost all leverage, right? Now he has to make this constructive discharge argument. He could have been maybe in a better position of leverage if he was fired for cause and now fight that. Now he has to basically say constructive discharge. So, I mean, I'll give it to you, Charles. I find it a fun exercise to figure out what he was maybe told by Davis, but there was some conversation that occurred.
I think that there's two ways that could have gone. Again, I'm not speaking here from a point of knowing exactly what, you know, transpired in that room between these two guys. Mark Davis could have gone the route of saying, okay, well, I know what the NFL has said to me. Maybe the NFL has told me if he moves on in this capacity, this is now all public. We have reasons to look more closely at John. You know, what is John in his capacity as Raiders head coach? We just did a workplace investigation, and we can decide whether or not we feel like it was a sham or, you know, legitimate, whatever. But there's already one workplace investigation. What is to say the NFL doesn't go, okay, Mark, if you don't remove John, there could be an investigation on the other side of that. Maybe we look at your franchise. Maybe we look at, is this what John was saying, what he was relaying in these messages, did that continue under your employee? So he comes into the Raiders, he continues to send these emails, and maybe Mark Davis sits there and goes, don't need that, don't want that, I don't want to fire John, but at the same time, I don't need to worry about whether or not this is now coming down the pipeline if John remains. So Mark moves to John and says, here's the situation. He doesn't tell John anything about the NFL leaning on Mark Davis or any of that. He just says, look, we're in a situation now here where either I have to fire you, you have to resign. I'm not going to share with you exactly why I feel this way. Or it could be the opposite. Mark could have walked in that room and said, look, I don't have another card in the deck here. The NFL is leaning on me. There's a potential that, you know, there could be a workplace investigation. And I'm not saying that this is what occurred, but we're theorizing this right now. We're playing this out to try and understand what Mark could have said and why he could have said it. And he could have told John, if you know, is there anything else here, emails, text messages that you sent since you've been Raiders coach, you know, that could come out in a workplace investigation, that could come out in, if the NFL wants you, they're going to come for you after this. And if I keep you aboard, they're going to come for you, and they're going to come for me, and they're going to come for the organization. Or you can resign right here, and we can just end it, and we'll work out the financial end of it on the other side. I think either one of those scenarios could have happened. I don't know that they did. But in a way, it comes down to, I think, Mark Davis. What did Mark Davis share with John, and what was he acting upon with John? Why was Mark Davis? Because remember, and I think some people kind of forget this, they knew about these emails to the point that John was already managing the narrative about these emails when he talked to Chris Mortensen at ESPN. The Friday before he coached that Bears game, he'd already told Chris Mortensen, there are some other emails that, you know, and he described them in very vague terms, but he talked about using, you know, a term to describe Roger Goodell. And so they clearly, he thought at that point, and I would think he probably thought that Mark Davis felt this way, we know what's coming. We've gotten beyond the DeMaurice Smith email, and now I'm trying to now manage what else is coming in the future, thinking I'm going to have a job. Like we're going to slug our way through this. But then at some point, something changed. He coached the game Monday. The emails that they already knew about then come out, And then at that point, you know, John resigns, but like there had to be some, there clearly had been interaction occurring between the league office and Mark Davis. It's just what put Mark into that mode? And then what did Mark share with John?
Here's my favorite thing. This is a podcast, so no one can see, but I'm putting on my tinfoil hat. I'm making it.
I love this part.
There's a lot of tinfoil. You know, we have St. Louis Rams fans in our mentions and our replies saying, was this a distraction to try to divert attention from the Rams lawsuit? I'm not sure. I think it's a fun exercise. Now people are saying, is the city of St. Louis, county of St. Louis, going to seek emergency discovery and try to see these 650,000 emails? So I'm saying to myself, I don't know, how many relevant emails are going to be in these 650,000, right? It's the Washington football team. Are they really talking about the St. Louis relocation? Now, tinfoil hat, Charles, you ready for this? I think you've hit the nail on the head here, and I'm really happy you got there. I think there probably would have been, if someone sends those heinous emails from 2011 to 2018, and then Jon Gruden's hired by the Raiders in 2018, someone like that doesn't stop sending those type of emails, right? Those emails would likely continue. I think that's a reasonable thought. Then if they do an email search, right, let's say there's 650,000 Raiders emails, right?
Right.
The Raiders are a team that relocated from Oakland to Las Vegas. That was a team that wanted to move to Los Angeles, and they lost the musical chairs, right? The Rams obviously won that, and the Chargers won that. That's a team that's much more likely to have emails that talk about relocation, significantly more likely. It would be odd if they didn't have those type of emails. So maybe that's the nexus between these two cases, right? Hey, let's shut this down really quickly. We don't know, right? And maybe the NFL, if this really is an outside entity that's leaking these emails, which I'm thinking maybe it is, it's possible. Imagine if then those emails come out and they can help the Rams case. So I do think, I don't necessarily think it's such a conspiracy theory. I think you're right that Davis maybe walked in, whatever the reason was, he goes, hey, let's cut this off right now. And then to Gruden's point, right? Gruden's hired a slew of assistant coaches and coaches all down his staff. Maybe he's saying, you know what? I want to save those guys' jobs. If I quit right now, maybe those emails won't be gone through. So there is a version here where this was all done to stop the Raiders investigation. But I don't know, I'll kick it to you.
And you know, there's an element too of in the midst of that, Jon Gruden sitting there and potentially thinking, well, look, at the end of this, I'm getting, you know, if I can fight this and get fired, or I can just leave now. Like I can, like either way, Gruden can say, at the end of this, regardless, I'm not going to be employed. Like more stuff can come out. Okay, maybe there's going to be a Raiders investigation. If I stay on, maybe, you know, the league then opens up some sort of a workplace investigation or just a very targeted Jon Gruden type of investigation to see what he continued to say while an employee of the Raiders. You're absolutely right about the discovery around the Raiders through the relocation process, no doubt would be germane to what was going on with St. Louis. I think it would be foolish to think that as much as Bruce Allen was talking, okay, and the people he was talking to, and Dan, whatever Dan's electronic communications are, and remember, I'm sure there was more than just emails here searched in the middle of a workplace investigation. You probably do an audit on text messages, right? Pretty much all forms of electronic communications, you're going to do an audit. So there's more out there than just the 650,000 emails. But through that relocation process for Stan Kroenke, you think Dan Snyder and Bruce Allen aren't talking about that? You think they're not talking about with other people in the league about Stan's situation in St. Louis or maybe Jerry Jones's involvement or John Mara's involvement or Clark Hunt's involvement or I mean, come on, Robert Kraft, you don't think that this is something that got discussed and that maybe in some of these executive meetings that they have where it's literally just the owners and they're essentially their number ones and the commissioner, these super private executive meetings that they have, is it impossible that some details from those meetings get discussed in text messages or emails or, hey, Stan said X about, you know, the city of St. Louis or the stadium or, and remember that that's another thing to consider too. The genesis of a lot of what happened inside of the St. Louis case and the move and all this was, it was stadium related. Well, what's Washington been going through for the last how many years? A stadium issue, you know, and you don't think these guys talk to each other about stadium issues and municipalities? And of course they do. Everybody does. You don't think there's probably discussions about muni bonds in there and about how things get funded in the NFL, how the government pays, you know, for some of these stadiums? I mean, all this stuff is, there's no question in my mind that there's a ton of stuff in there that we don't even consider being in there that the league doesn't want to hit the light of day. And by the way, there's no way anyone went through 650,000 emails. Like, there's no way we went through the 650. No, you did a forensic audit. No one sat there and paged through 650,000 emails. Where's the army of people who did this? You know, come on, let's be realistic about this. When people say we went through the emails, no, you did a forensic audit the same way everybody does a forensic audit with key search terms. Some things come back. Maybe you do targeted searches for certain individuals. Maybe you look through Bruce's emails. Maybe you look through Dan's emails, but you didn't look through every single email that was sent in the span.
Let's transition this into a related topic. The Oakland Raiders went through a relocation, and that issue is the subject of a lawsuit and now an appeal before the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. And then there's a parallel state court appeal addressing some of the same issues that are being litigated in St. Louis. So you wrote a pretty explosive piece about how the John Gruden email situation could be the tip of the iceberg for the National Football League. And you focused on the St. Louis trial as being sort of the forum in which the NFL's, you know, quest for secrecy is going to run into, you know, the sort of the public forum of a jury trial. Why do you think that this is the tip of the iceberg, and how does it kind of play into the St. Louis trial?
The point I try to make is the NFL, what is frightening for the NFL about the St. Louis trial beyond monetary damages, which obviously I think is number one, you know, sitting there and thinking the number that could be on the other side of this, if it goes to trial and a jury comes, obviously sides with the city, is the lack of the ability to control not just the narrative, but also that discovery process, the lack of ability to control what gets said on the witness stand, the questions that get asked. And let me tie it in sort of a different angle here. When the Colin Kaepernick grievance gets heard, right? All that discovery included a number of owners sitting down for depositions, taped. There's a camera there, okay? And they're answering all these questions. And as a league, you have to hope that their answers and their demeanor, what they say, how they do, and the way they say it is all state of the art. You have to hope for that. You have to hope there's no breakdown. You have to hope that Bob McNair, may he rest in peace, was perfect in that interview when he's asked about inmates running the prison, when he's asked about social justice, all these different things. I think a settlement in which all of that discovery never hits the light of day, we haven't seen a shred of anything that came out of that, is suggestive that is what we thought it was. The NFL wanted to pay to make sure this gets locked away forever. We don't ever have to worry about that. And clearly the NDA signed on the other side of that were ironclad, because to this day, we've had people suggest what the financial settlement amount was, but there's never really been anything that's come out in terms of what came out in that discovery process. I think the NFL's fears getting dragged into discovery, fears opening its books, just like we've had these owners who don't even want to, you know, Robert Kraft, I own 32 different businesses. like it's John Mara. I don't know what my, you know, I'm not sure what my team's really actually worth. They don't want to face the financial end of the discovery, but I also think they don't want to face what else might get dredged up in that process of discovery. And this St. Louis case is beyond just the finances of it. There's also the laundry end of it.
Charles, I've walked clients into discovery issues in both state court and federal court. I've never had clients be as openly defiant as these five NFL owners that are all of a sudden, you know, like Chance the Gardener from being there. You know, they don't know anything.
Right.
Sergeant Fields, I don't know what my team is worth. It's the only asset I own.
That's my favorite, by the way.
Yeah, and by the way, for having only one venture in his entire life, he's not very good at it either.
Ask Tish. I'll bet Tish knows. You know, or just ask the other, you know, someone go ask Steve Tish. What are the Giants worth? He probably knows, or he can tell you immediately.
Put me into the mindset of why these owners who are sophisticated businessmen, well, maybe everyone except Mara, but why are those owners actually subjecting themselves to the possibility of a civil contempt hearing where they could get real sanctions imposed, you know, against them? I think Mike Florio has theorized that they're tanking the case on purpose and they're going to take their chances with a default judgment rather than go in front of a, you know, an open court. I'm not buying that argument, because we're only talking about four owners and not all 32 owners, not the Rams, not Kroenke, not the NFL. You follow these people. You've followed the business of the league. Why are they doing this?
Well, you know, I think in particular, the aspect of the finances, if there's anything where I could see this level of defiance, it would be the finances, because that is obviously, Green Bay is different. It's a municipally owned team. But I mean, every other owner, what is indoctrinated in you when you get into the fraternity, it's that your books are, you don't show people your books. You don't show people the money you're really making. You don't, you know, people know the TV deals and they know the revenue cuts, this, that, and the other, but you don't show people the exact finances of what you're earning as an NFL team. So I think maybe that's part of it. But I also think, look, let's be honest. The NFL has a history of hiring firms that aid them in obstinance, you know, that tell them this is always the path to take. You be obstinate, you don't give anything up, and we'll deal with everything punitively until it comes to a point where we can't, until it's too costly, until there's too much flesh being extracted. And so far, I would argue that at least up until this point, I mean, what was the fine? Like, what was it, like $1,000 a day?
It was $1,000 a day for once they were late. And by the way, they never paid that fine.
No.
and then the judge's sanction was basically a makeup and aggregating all those $1,000 a day fines to $25,000. But he gave them basically put them on double secret probation and set a hearing for December 3rd. If they haven't come back by December 3rd with the information that is responsive to the financial information requests that the judge's order, you know, requires, he's going to really sanction them.
Oh, yeah.
Striking their pleadings and entering a judgment against them.
But I think you fight it. Like I said, I think they will fight it right up until that point. I would say it's almost akin to, I have covered things in the past where people knew discovery was coming or a trial was coming, and yet people will fight it right up until that point where you almost have to walk in and sit down in front of a camera. And then you go, okay, let's do a deal. Like, it's time.
You're right. It buys them time, 6 weeks to try to settle this case. Yep. And when they settle the case, none of this stuff is known. But the truth is that even if this financial net worth information was produced as part of discovery, all of that would be under a confidentiality order by the court. The public wouldn't see it. And any lawyer who disseminates that faces the real wrath of the court and sanctions himself. Nobody would know about this stuff. It's not going to leak like the NFL, you know, might be leaking some of the emails around the WFT investigation. So let's talk about the prospect of the settlement. There is a wide delta between how the two parties in this lawsuit view the economic worth of the case. Look, St. Louis thinks that these relocation guidelines are a contract. The NFL does not. St. Louis thinks that if their theory is true or this, it is a contract to which they have the rights as a third-party beneficiary, their damages could include the inflated value of the Rams franchise, could include a disgorgement of the NFL's relocation fee. The NFL does not share that view. So when you think about how these two sides view the worth of the lawsuit, do you see any pathway to a potential settlement? Can this case settle? Will the NFL settle it at some point between now and January 10th? And why do you think that?
Not if it hinges on the enrichment of Stan Kroenke and that franchise value, because we're talking billions. That number in terms of the value change in the Rams being an element of damages is so huge that I just can't see the NFL. They'd much rather settle, but if they can't find a settlement figure that's appropriate, you fight like hell to get it moved. Because you think you can't, they're sitting there going, we're going to go in and this jury is going to eat us alive. I think they're doing what they're doing right now because they think Stan's got to write a $1 billion check. And if he's indemnified all these other owners, he's going to write this $1 billion check. And, or this is going to go to, you know, a jury. And if that becomes part of it, the inflated value of now the Rams through this process that should have never taken place or at least contractually should not have taken place. What does that billion move to? Like, you tell me. I mean, what can the damages be at that point?
You're looking at basically four types of categories of damages. You're looking at the relocation fee, the increased value of the team relocating to Los Angeles due to the move, lost, and let's not forget lost income and revenues. You know the loss of tourism taxes, use taxes, sales taxes, the value of the dome, and the income. The economic, you know, impact to the city from having a franchise for the next 20 years. Maybe that number is 100 to 150 million. And then the expenditures and reliance on the NFL's, you know, sort of lulling the city into believing that it had a chance to keep the team. And then punitive damages. So there. The punitive damages can't be assessed on the relocation fee or on the increased valuation of the team because those are contractual remedies, and punitive damages can only be assessed in connection with tort claims. And the tort claims are the fraudulent misrepresentation and the tortious interference. And the damages under those are presumably the out-of-pockets and the lost income. So it really requires a sophisticated damages analysis against the backdrop of not knowing how an appellate court might rule after the fact. So, right. You know, in terms of reducing this to a monetary settlement, it's almost an impossible endeavor, which is why I threw out the possibility a couple of weeks ago, and that idea seems to have taken hold, not because of me, but there's some, you know, belief through, you know, Florio's reporting and some of my damages analysis that an expansion franchise could be the way to bridge the gap. Is that something that you see as being realistic?
I would not take it. Let me put it this way. I would not take anything off the table just because of not knowing how big that number could be. It's, to me, it's probably the path of least resistance is to say, okay, let's settle this. Let's figure something out. And let's say we're going to get a team there. We're going to get a team, you know, let's, at the end of the road, what you really want back is you want a franchise. And guess what? It won't have Stan Kroenke attached to it. Start fresh and go from there. It's probably, oddly enough, the easiest path to getting this done. And it's also, there are enough people out there that want franchises, you know, Jeff Bezos would pay for a franchise tomorrow. And, you know, it's, you know, whether it's buying the Broncos or it's, you know, I still believe deep down that if they really pitched London to Jeff Bezos, like, hey, we'll really figure out how to do an overseas franchise and you're the guy with the net worth for it. Yeah. I think that's something that if you're the NFL, you would have to actually consider because, and remember, it's also, that's a net positive, right? I mean, it's versus just writing a check or going before a jury and getting destroyed and getting hammered with a financial judgment. That's a net negative. Oh, by the way, there's also the, who knows what this does to the relocation process moving forward? Who knows what this does? You know, if you go through this process, you don't know, you could be corrupting your ability to have teams move in the future, or at the very least, you're shackling it. You're saying, we got a laundry list of things you can't do if you're going to move. And, you know, here's this checklist now. If you go, so there's all kinds of other unanticipated really damages here. I don't think that's a far-fetched idea that at some point, but my question is, who makes that offer? Does the NFL make that offer? Or do you have plaintiffs who are sitting here saying, okay, you know, on the plaintiff side, someone has to say, hey, how about you just give us, like, let's work this out, cut a check, but, you know, make sure we get an expansion franchise. Who makes that offer?
It's hard to imagine that those types of conversations are having or taking place now in this climate.
When yeah, I don't.
Is seeking the disqualification of St. Louis's lead trial lawyer. They're seeking to move the case out of St. Louis because, quote unquote, the city has undue influence over its citizenry. And by the way, that citizenry is prejudiced against the NFL. And then, of course, the city of St. Louis is seeking severe sanctions and a contempt finding against the owners. I can't imagine that this is the climate in which to have that conversation. But those steps leading up to the courthouse,
yes, right there,
can act as a significant motivator and catalyst to that kind of discussion. Well, certainly before the jury returns a verdict.
You don't want to have that. You don't have that discussion until your leverage is at its highest point, right? Like, why? Because you'd be giving it away. Let the NFL throw everything out there. Let them make every legal maneuvering they can. And up until now, it's failed. If that failure continues, plaintiff's leverage does nothing but increase. And eventually you may get to a point where you can name what you want. If you want an expansion franchise, you may actually put yourself in a position where you can say that and it can be realistically granted. But I do think we're not quite through the process of litigating this or the maneuverings that are occurring right now. You know, I think the NFL still thinks in its mind there are outs here. Or at the very least, the lawyers are like, there's still billable hours. There's a lot of billable hours still here. There's more to get.
I think the out potentially, and it's a long shot bid, it would be the emergency or extraordinary petition for writ of prohibition to move the trial out of St. Louis. I mean, if you place this in some far-flung county, like, you know, right, near Kansas City, for example,
right,
maybe you arrive at a different level of emotion and you don't face the same kind of, you know, enemy territory that you might within St. Louis. And of course, there's also disqualifying the main trial lawyer, which is a big issue. And I don't think the NFL is out of legal options. They're going to keep filing these extraordinary writ petitions. They've already filed 10 in the case. They've lost all 10. I think they might try to revisit Judge McGraw's summary judgment ruling. So while it's the 11th hour, that's a long 60 minutes between 11 p.m. and 12 p.m. to get to January 10th. The NFL is going to try everything to pare away this case or get it kicked out or moved.
I really truly believe, though, that the ball game is, at least from the NFL's standpoint, I mean, there's a lot that goes into this, but I really truly believe they think the ball game is where the trial takes place. I think if it completely changes, for lack of a better term here, in their mind, the winnability, you know, the path to a potential victory. If it happens, the lawyers for the NFL are sitting there going, we're going to be arguing in front of a jury that is basically should just be the plaintiffs. Like they are going to be deciding either in their own favor. That's how the NFL looks at this. You're going to have jurors who are sitting there deciding either to rule in favor of themselves or in favor of the NFL. Like it's not about these two entities out here that we're looking at. No, it's about me sitting there, Charles Robinson, St. Louis resident, going, I can side with myself here. And then something that will, you know, enrich my community or my tax base or, you know, whatever. I mean, in some way, shape or form will enrich my municipality I can decide against myself.
And by the way, on one level, you're making a very strong case for the notion that there's like bias, but that argument's not going to fly in court. I think in 1984, the NFL and the city of Oakland tried to have a case, you know, involving the original Raiders relocation moved to a different county for all the same reasons the NFL is arguing now, that, you know, the citizens who serve on the jury would derive some kind of indirect financial benefit from socking the NFL with a damage award that could indirectly flow to them as taxpayers. That theory has been rejected, and there really hasn't been too much adverse publicity or pretrial publicity. This case was really, you know, not even on forget the national radar. It didn't get a lot of front page day-to-day coverage through 4 years. I don't think it's risen to the level of the type of pretrial publicity that you might see in a murder case.
Right.
Where, you know, you have to move the criminal trial into another county so that the defendant, you know, who's fighting for his life and his liberty can have a fair trial. Fighting for your economic, you know, damages, I don't think it rises to the same level of importance as a criminal defendant in a felony case receiving a fair trial.
And is it even provable? I understand what their argument is and I understand what their assumption is, but can you prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that every single juror that you could potentially seat for this is biased, that is tainted? You can't prove that.
You can screen those out very easily. Charles, have you ever served on jury duty?
State court? I absolutely have. And that's why you pay someone in your firm to pick the right jury, right? There's a reason why you go through that process. It's incumbent upon the NFL to help weed out. The NFL plays a part in that process.
Well, the judge does.
The judge does.
In the Raiders case in the 1984, the judge and the defendant, I think they submitted a 48-page questionnaire to the jurors or prospective jurors to weed out those who, you know, follow football or season ticket holders. You can find 12, you know, impartial jurors in a city as big as St. Louis that really don't give a whit about football or Stan Kroenke. It shouldn't be that difficult, but...
The NFL's going to argue everyone in St. Louis is jury hunting on this one. Everyone is, and will answer. They'll sit there and they'll go every question. They're like, this is more likely to keep me on the jury or off the jury. I'm going to answer however I can to keep myself on this jury, whatever my motivations are. I will keep those. I will tailor those to whatever leads me to sitting in that position.
Well, if you see Gene Hackman in the audience, you know something's up.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Before I let you go, I want to turn to the one aspect of this case that we haven't considered, which is not who's going to win or lose, but the fallout. Assume the NFL goes to trial, loses big, it's upheld on appeal. What's going to be the fallout here for other municipalities, for maybe people like Kroenke, Goodell, What is this going to do? Just look ahead and into the future. What's really at stake here for the NFL besides the money?
Well, I would think first and foremost, if you feel aggrieved, it could have some impact, obviously. It's not a one-to-one because it's different state laws, different, you know, with Oakland. But at the very least, beyond even Oakland, let's say that snakes through and it never rises to the level of what has happened in St. Louis. In the future, I would think most cities, most municipalities, when a team departs, their swords have been crossed. Like it's not a happy thing ever. Anytime an NFL team leaves town, there are people who are upset and now have, for lack of a better term, a blueprint to sit here and go, okay, how was this accomplished? Like St. Louis beat the NFL. They beat Stan Kroenke. They beat this owner. What can we pick through in this particular case that we might now be able, that overlaps our situation here? And maybe on the flip side of that too, though, it does also offer the NFL a blueprint of like what not to do. Okay, here are all the missteps. Here are all the mistakes. How did we arrive at this point that we never thought we would arrive to? And it may even teach you a lesson about settlements too. When do you settle? Like, how long do you settle? Like, if there's an aggrieved party on the other end, maybe you try to settle immediately rather than dragging this out over a number of years and putting yourself into this situation. So I just think from a relocation standpoint, I don't want to say it would have a chilling effect, but it would definitely change. I don't know that you would have the Mayflower trucks packing up in the middle of the night and spiriting away a franchise again. You know, things that we've seen happen in the past. I don't know that I think it would be a much more thoughtful process. Not that this wasn't, but let's be honest. I mean, clearly there were things here that went down that shouldn't have.
Well, Charles, I could talk to you for a couple more hours. I've been a big fan of your work for a long time.
Likewise.
Thank you. As an appellate lawyer, I really love great writing. And not only are you plugged into the league and have great insights, but your writing style, it's just really an enjoyable read. I put you up there. I don't mean to rank writers, but I love your work, Mike Florio's work. And I always learn a lot when I read your articles. So thank you for your debut on Conduct Detrimental. I hope to have you. I hope you'll be willing to join us again sometime in the future. Maybe we'll even see you in St. Louis.
I really appreciate it. I was pre-law, by the way. When I went to school, I went to college, I was pre-law, but a year in, I was like, I don't think I could do this. It's way too many. Like when I looked at the years, the number of years and, you know, getting to the other end of it, but it never left me. Like I love, lawyers are my favorite people. Like it's because it's said by somebody
who doesn't have to work with them.
Well, but I enjoy working with them. I feel like it's a one-stop shop where you meet individuals who have to be creative. They have to have the ability to, you know, the thought process, the cognitive process that goes into the work. They have to grind. They have to be counselors to clients. They have to, I mean, it's just, I've always told people, the one thing that I've learned, particularly when I did the investigative stint, pay for the good lawyer. Whatever you do, whatever you did, pay for the good lawyer, because the good lawyers, I can tell you every good lawyer I've dealt with. And I can tell you, I would never name, we could have that. This is off the podcast conversation. Yeah. I can tell you the ones that I'm like, this person should have paid for a better lawyer, because every good lawyer I've met is worth every cent.
Well, I can tell you from watching the Raiders and the Rams relocation lawsuits, there's no danger of that not happening. The parties on both sides are ably represented. And I'm really looking forward to seeing Jim Quinn get back in action in the city of Oakland's lawsuit against the Raiders and the NFL. I have a strong feeling from watching the Ninth Circuit oral argument that those antitrust claims are going to be reinstated. And Oakland is going to be, you know, kind of catching up to St. Louis sometime in the near future. And Jim Quinn's one of the legendary, you know, sports antitrust litigators. So that case could take on a very high profile very soon. But, you know, I just loved having you on. And, thank you for spending close to an hour with Dan and I. It was, you know, great conversation. And we'll catch up again with you soon. And maybe I'll see you in St. Louis on January 10th.
Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate it. Thank you very much for having me. And if you ever want to have me on again, I'm more than happy to come on. And I got to tell you, I don't know that there's a single Twitter account that I have followed over the last few years that has brought more paper into the light for, you know, oftentimes I think a lot of people, they read about you know, something that's snaking its way through a court process, or there's a motion that's been filed or whatever, and it's us explaining what it is. But I think it's far more helpful to have someone like you who says, here it is, read it yourself, like here. And that to me is just completely invaluable. Like, I love it. I every time I open my Twitter, if you're in my feed and I see a document, I'm like, oh, like, here we go. All right. Like this morning, I was like, awesome. Here we go. I really appreciate the work you do. It's awesome.
Thank you. I found my calling as the Indiana Jones of NFL sports law.
It's lucrative. It's a lucrative business these days.
Yeah, $0 per hour. I'm waiting for that royalty. Give Yahoo a call. They're missing out on something really great here. But thank you very much for the compliment and for spending an hour with us. And I'll try to keep it going with some of those archival documents. And certainly as we get closer to trial, there'll be many, many, many more of them. Great talking to you, Charles. Have a wonderful day. And thanks again for joining us on Conduct Detrimental.
Thank you, Daniel. I appreciate it.
That was Charles Robinson of Yahoo Sports. Dan, listen, I think Charles is a great guest for this, but we got Charles's take on this. You think this Gruden story has legs? You think this is going to be something kicking around for a while?
You know, this is not going to be the end of the email leaks. I mean, there have already been, I think, three successive, you know, news dumps that have been embarrassing to either John Gruden, Bruce Allen, or to NFL General Counsel Jeffrey Pesch. Whoever has these emails doesn't just have three emails. There's something going on here where somebody's trying to embarrass the league. I think this isn't the end of the story, but we'll see where it goes. 650,000 emails is a lot of emails to go through, and the NFL could not have possibly concluded its review of all 650,000. So I think this story is ongoing and the fallout remains to be seen. Who else it ensnares as a possible victim, I guess we'll find out. Certainly, you know, there are three identifiable victims already, but it's a long way to go to get through 650,000. But while that is unknown, what is known is that the NFL marches to its trial in the city of St. Louis on January 10th. And there are going to be some pretrial wranglings regarding changing the venue of the trial and other types of, you know, motions to try to narrow the issues or get some aspects of the case thrown out of court. So I'm more intrigued by what's definitely in front of us because I can't predict what will unfold with Gruden. I do hope for, you know, our purposes, we're sports lawyers. I would love to see Gruden file that lawsuit against the National Football League and get into some of the discovery around this.
So I think the allure of both of these is really this element that NFL is being kind of targeted. People want to know what's going on behind closed doors. It's really this issue of transparency, right? 650,000 emails, and only John Gruden is the fall guy, right? That doesn't necessarily make sense. And then you have all these emails with respect to the Rams case, right? I mean, we'll see what comes of this discovery if the city of St. Louis is going to go after these 650,000 emails. But it's another question of what these owners were saying behind closed doors, if there is evidence of negotiating in bad faith behind the scenes. So, you know, I think that's why the NFL is getting dinged, right? This lack of transparency, this kind of theory that they're hiding stuff. But again, as we kind of talked about with Charles, the NFL is a private entity. So there's no real obligation for them to disclose these emails or what goes on behind the scenes. But that's why you have a trial, a public facing trial and live court testimony, which would be fantastic for us. And then let's see if they release these emails, Dan. I can't necessarily predict it, but if they do, it'd be fantastic for us. I mean, Dan, this is the perfect segue. Transparency, right? Of all people that are transparent, you don't have to worry about. Maybe you worry about the NFL. Do not worry about Themis Bar Review. Get 100% transparency with Themis Bar Review. They are the only bar review course to publish consistent pass rates every year. They make your success their number one priority. So make sure to visit themisbar.com/condetrimental. So our sponsor knows we sent you, and then you could tell us all the great things that you read on our Twitter. You could tell them, and I'm sure it would make them happy. Dan, I think this transparency element is the thing that ties these things together, though.
Yeah, well, you know, as Charles pointed out in his articles, transparency is something that the National Football League is not accustomed to, and it will have no choice but to have transparency around its relocation decision when it faces a St. Louis jury for 8 weeks in January and February of 2022. So the league is not used to transparency, but now it's going to have to basically, you know, face the music on how it conducts business relative to its relocation guidelines. So we're going to get it in one area. Whether we get that with the Gruden emails, I don't think that ever comes voluntarily simply because people are asking for it. If it comes out at all, it's going to be through court-ordered discovery, either because somebody like Gruden files a lawsuit or some other victim of the leaking of emails files a lawsuit. There is certainly going to be some viable claims if other individuals are targeted by the, you know, selective release of these NFL emails.
So that'll put this episode in the books. Three quick notes, and then we'll call it a day. We tried to keep this episode pretty tight to NFL issues. Evander Kane, who we've covered extensively, suspended 21 games by the NHL for basically submitting a fake vaccination passport, not for anything relating to domestic violence, not for anything relating to gambling, but 21 games, basically a quarter of the season. Kyrie Irving is still not agreeing to get vaccinated, a separate standoff with the Brooklyn Nets. Obviously, I did a hit on Fox Business about that. We have that up, some more articles on our website relating to that. And last but not least, a story which I think we'll come back to in the coming weeks, a story about minor leaguers finally getting some respect from Major League Baseball. In addition to a pay raise, they're going to be getting some housing upgrades, which is a fantastic development to see. So that'll put this episode in the books. Dan Wallach, as always, is on social media at Wallach Legal. Myself, Dan Lust, at Sports Law Lust. The show at Con Detrimental on Twitter and Instagram. And the website, the booming website, we have now exceeded significantly more, not significantly more, more than 100,000 hits on the website. It's a fantastic to see. 100,000 listens to this podcast. I'd love to see the growth of it. And we'll keep growing. We'll keep trucking. Again, to the extent you want to contribute, we're basically a startup at this point. We're just picking up more features. We got the newsletter that Taryn's running with, Stephanie Weissenberger and Jason Morin running with the website and the articles. And Mike obviously edits this podcast. So we're a well-oiled machine. To the extent you do want to join up with us, again, DM's always open. You can always find me on social media. For Dan and myself, we will see you next week on another episode of Conduct Detrimental.